Hello, and welcome to episode 249 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I was thinking recently about a young mother I once saw riding a crowded subway late at night with two young children. The kids were restless, the mother was clearly exhausted, and many of the passengers on that train responded with irritated looks instead of sympathy. That moment stuck with me because it feels connected to something larger. Most people say they support families and children in theory, but children can be noisy, disruptive, and inconvenient, and a society that truly welcomes families requires adults to tolerate some messiness and unpredictability. Right now, birth rates are falling rapidly across much of the world. In many countries, including the United States, having children has increasingly shifted from something people simply expected to do into a highly personal and carefully weighed choice. Some of the reasons for this are clearly positive: greater freedom for women, better education, and more control over family planning. But many people also seem deeply anxious about the future itself. They worry about housing costs, politics, climate change, artificial intelligence, and even whether bringing children into today's world is even the responsible thing to do. And while I understand these fears, human beings have always raised families amid uncertainty. If people wait for the future to feel completely safe and predictable, that moment will likely never come. So, Rick, let's start here. What does it say about a society when fewer people feel hopeful or confident enough to build the next generation?
So, two parts to my answer. First of all, I would say it's not a very virtuous society in which people are not hopeful enough to build the next generation. Hope is a virtue. It's a quality of mind that we should be cultivating. And there is no reason why the world should be thought of as any worse than it ever has been. In fact, there's all kinds of reasons to think that the world is much better. We've talked about them on this show. And so this despairing attitude towards the future is something that's prevalent now, and yet it's not an excuse. It's like that is a symptom itself that is, should be addressed. I'd also say that's probably not the main reason that birth rates are dropping, even though many people, especially many young people, say that that's the reason they're deciding not to have kids, or they want to explain why other people are not having kids for that reason. Or having fewer kids. But I don't think that's the main thing. And it's maybe a contributing factor, but there's probably other explanations. It's just that nobody seems to know what the explanation is.
And you don't have a theory right now.
We see this happening when societies become more advanced. And what happens as societies become more advanced, we become more independently minded, less social. As people are less social, they tend to marry later and hook up less. And so, like, there's just less social interaction, so that children aren't born as early in a life. And then there's not as many children when people finally do get married. And so there all these things, these are causes, but the different reasons people give for, like, it's this reason or that reason, like, no, there's a whole bunch of factors going on together that are contributing to these falling birth rates. It's dropping really rapidly in some countries and not so much in others, and it's really hard to figure out why.
Yeah, but it is dropping a lot of places in a lot of countries. So this is not just a U.S. thing by any stretch. And there was a podcast I know we both listened to that at least sort of convinced me this might be a good topic for us to discuss. But Derek Thompson had on one of the nation's best demographers, and he was just laying out some of the facts about this. And 2.1 is the number that stuck with me. And that really is the number of children a woman women on average should have. Of course, you can't have one-tenth of a child, but I think people understand how this works. And if you have on average 2.1 children per woman, you're around the area of replacement level. Then you're going to, and for many, many years, that number was double that. I mean, and that, of course, we also had, if you go back hundreds of years, a lot, much, much higher childhood mortality rate. And we've solved that mostly in this country and largely in other parts of this world. But there are many countries that are falling well below that 2.1 replacement level number. And some of those countries didn't surprise me. I mean, we've heard a lot about parts of Europe and went from anywhere from Sweden to Italy, and they're falling below that number. The United States is still, I think if my memory is right on this, pretty flat right now on that. But what really surprised me is there are countries in Latin America, including Mexico and Brazil, where they're at like at 1.6, 1.7, which is, you know, well below replacement level. And this demographer believes, and I think there's, you know, good reason to back this up, and this was something that I'm surprised didn't make big headlines, but he believes that 2023 was sort of the year where the most people may have been born ever in the world, and now we're starting to retrench. And of course, because most people die much later in life, that we may not see populations start to fall for another 30 or 40 years. But it is interesting, and kind of what he said in the show, and we'll certainly link to it, was if you care about the future, the two things you should really care about are AI, which we've talked about on this show, and the falling fertility rate, which we've really not talked a lot about on this show. There's economic reasons why this is important, and we talked to countries like Italy that has a very aging population that needs services and healthcare, and there's not a lot of young people out there to help pay the bill on those things. And you look at, you know, workforce and all sorts of things. This is can make a meaningful economic impact, but there's also a societal impact on this as well. And I think maybe the question I'll have for you is, it was not that long ago that a young couple felt kind of awkward or had to explain themselves if they chose not to have children. And anymore, that's not that unusual. And that change has certainly happened, I mean, I would say within our lifetime, but within our like recent memory. And like you, I can't pinpoint a reason. I think it's probably bad, but I also certainly understand why people make that choice.
I think people make the choice because we're a more individualistic society, and that like this is what happens. And the norm has shifted so much, where it used to be like couples that would choose not to have children would be asked why not, sometimes, and sometimes it was like because they couldn't.
Yeah, there were some medical reasons, certainly. But
now what seems to be outside the norm is having large families.
Oh, yeah.
So like a family with, say, 4 or 5 children, then the question is, why are you having so many children, right? And I think a lot of the questioning about the large families is because, like, you and I grew up with all these dire warnings about population explosion.
There were books written about this, that we're going to run out of food, we're going to run out of water, we're just going to have too many people. And thankfully, again, there's parts of the world that are struggling with famine and climate change sort of stacked on top of that, but we're not seeing any of these dire outcomes that people 40 years ago predicted.
And they're generally not population driven.
Yeah.
They're driven by civil conflict and sometimes environmental change as contribute to that, but it's not just simply overpopulation. And that's because we've made so many technological advances, mainly in agriculture, where crop yields are much, much greater than they ever have been. Dairy farms yield much more milk per dairy cow than they did 50 years ago. And so there's this incredible increase in yield. And so we're able to feed everybody if we can just distribute it without problems. Of course, you mentioned the economic problems. If you don't have replacement rate, then you increasingly rely on fewer young people to drive the economy to support people that are no longer working.
As people continue to live longer.
Yeah, and we have a baby boom generation retiring. We're going to have a record number of retirees. Like even right now, we already have a record number with fewer young people working. And that number is going to continue to decline, especially in certain parts of the country. We're also seeing cutbacks at schools, a lot of school closings. It's strange to see, like, even as we have a housing crisis and an affordability crisis for housing, we have fewer children. So what's going on there? This is a distribution problem, right? We don't have supplies where people are demanding them. But a lot of this happens with a declining population.
And I wonder, too, how much of it's societally driven. I'll give an example that at least shows a little bit of my perspective on this. But in our neighborhood, several houses down, are two parents with young families, and they live next to each other. And I can't exactly tell you how many kids each of these two households has, but they, as best I can tell, they seem to intermingle a lot, and they seem to be outside in the summertime, at least now, all the time. And like, I'm no expert on kids, but they seem to like genuinely be having fun and doing, you know, fun things for them. And
but
probably
things, like kids at a young age like that, they laugh all the time.
Yeah. And they're being active on various things, and they seem to be like, they like kind of creating these games.
Maybe
for themselves.
That's why our society is undergoing this mass depression right now, is we just don't have enough kids laughing in our presence us cheerful.
Sure. And so all that's happening. And like, if the windows are open and, you know, things are, I can kind of hear them in the background, but I've said a number of times, like, well, I'm glad they're having a great time, but I wouldn't want to live next to them. And I still sort of stand behind that. But at the same time, I realize that goes against my whole strongly held belief that, like, kids are good. And using my example at the start of the show, you know, when kids are at their worst, we should be more sympathetic to the parents who are having to deal with these difficult kids, because they're likely doing the best job they can. But then there's people like me who are like, well, thank God I'm four doors down from this. I don't know if you're going to change my mind, but you can try.
They are the kids who are going to be working in the hospitals and nursing homes when you are needing help someday. And do you want them to be compassionate, kind, generous people? Or do you want them to be mean-spirited and selfish? And like we have a responsibility to make sure that they grow up to be good people. And that means that we should all do our part to treat them well and to make an investment in making sure that they have a good upbringing. This is why I hate seeing like the lack of interest in making sure that we take care of, especially preventive health care for children. I mean, we've got declining birth rates. We have fewer children to take care of. Let's make sure we really take care of the ones we have really well and provide a good upbringing for them. So our investments in schools and healthcare, especially for children, like, this is something we should be talking about all the time.
And to take that even a step further, I mean, there's some people who hearing that would say, yes, and we should do more for paid parental leave. And we also, and maybe the biggest ticket item of all, is providing some sort of public subsidy, at least for a large portion of our society, around childcare, because that would make many parents, women oftentimes especially, feel more free to have more kids if they know that there's a way where they can continue to earn money for their family and enrich their lives while still having kids.
I agree with that, but I don't agree with the reasons given.
Okay.
So I think we should be providing more public subsidies for childcare, because I think it's the right thing to do for the children, to make sure that the children are brought up well, especially in a culture where oftentimes both parents are working. I don't believe in the affordability argument that the reason families are not having as many children is because it's so expensive, because relatively speaking, it was much more expensive to have children in the past, and people just had children anyway.
And because, and also we know that 50 years ago, probably more, that food was a much larger part of people's budget than it is today. Again, setting aside if you want to dine out. And that obviously the more mouths you have to feed, the more expensive things get. And on a per mouth basis, things are cheaper today than they probably, I mean, there's been a bit of inflation, but still comparatively, it's still pretty cheap.
I remember going back a while and showing my wife the places that I lived in, these different rental houses that my parents lived in, like the first 5 years that I was growing up. And I couldn't believe how bad they were. Like they were, these are really dingy places.
And look how you turned out.
Well, like my parents didn't wait until they were financially settled to have kids. They got married and they started having kids. That's what people did. My wife and I waited a while, but we still, like, we're getting to the point where she's going to be turning 30, and we decide we better have a child now. And we're both still in graduate school, and we didn't have any regular incomes, and we didn't know how we were going to afford it. And like, we just, like, found a way to do it. Like, there's, like, you find a way. I don't believe in the affordability argument. I think that people give it as a reason, but put it this way. Even if we provided all kinds of free childcare, it wouldn't make any noticeable difference in the fertility rate in this country.
And I would love to say you're wrong, but the United States is facing this problem, but so are countries like the Nordic states, and they have a much more robust social safety net, and they also have this problem, and they've even tried to be more aggressive around some of these issues, and it just does not seem to be moving the needle really at all in their birth rates. But you're around college age people all the time, and I'm guessing the majority of them don't have young kids at home, but they're probably thinking about starting a family at some point. Have you heard more over the past, I don't know, 5-10 years about sort of that conversation about bringing children into a world today that is so uncertain and the future so unknown is just irresponsible?
Well, this is anecdotal and based on really small sample, and it's just based on me for many years now asking graduating seniors, where do they see themselves in 5 to 10 years? In the past, like 10 years ago, when I started asking that question, it was always about career, and sometimes it would be places where they wanted to go and wanted to live. This year, for the first time, a majority of both men and women said that they wanted to be married and have kids. And I was really surprised by that, because that wasn't, you know, like 10 years ago, it wasn't a socially acceptable answer.
Mm-hmm.
You're at a college and you're preparing for a career. They thought, like, the socially responsible answer is what career you're going to have. And that's what they were focused on. So again, this is a very small sample, but maybe we're hitting a turning point here where we're seeing young people are kind of noticing what's going on in the world, and they're saying they want to return to a less individualized life and more of a socially meaningful and family-oriented style of life.
And I was talking to somebody about this a couple of days ago in preparation for this show, and he would very much identify as someone who is left of center. And I don't know this to be true, but I sense that it probably is that the people who are saying things like, it may not be responsible to bring a child into the world today, and you with climate change and political uncertainty and economic troubles ahead and all this stuff, that's more likely someone who is on the left side of the aisle than on the right. And I think, again, not exclusively, but people on the right are probably a little more, are having children at a higher rate. And my friend on the left's response was that he agrees, he thinks that's true. And that, therefore, it is the people on the left's responsibility to have more kids to balance this whole thing out. And I mean, that's probably like, there's some truth to that, right? If I mean, obviously how you're raised is not entirely predictive of what your future politics will be, but that's certainly one of the leading indicators.
Yeah, that, like how you're raised, where you're raised.
Yeah.
Like, and it is true that children of liberal parents are more pessimistic,
yes,
about the future. Like, if you're right, or that, like, that factors into why people are having fewer children, it could be part of the reason that's why liberals are tending to have fewer children is because of how they're raised.
And my theory, which again I can't prove, is that there are many people, maybe liberal, maybe not, who just look at kids as sort of an inconvenience, and they realize the expense involved, and they aren't told enough maybe about the positive thing. So then when they're asked why they're not having kids, you don't want to say, well, Rick, I don't want to have kids because I'm selfish and I want to, you know, all the money I make or my spouse and I make, we just want to keep for ourselves. You can sort of pivot and sound better by saying, well, the world's a real unpredictable place right now, and it doesn't seem responsible to bring a child into this. I think that does sound better than just like, I'm selfish.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's an interesting observation. I think one of the effects of having children is that you become less selfish. Not that you become less selfish, you become less self-centered. Because so much of your time is focused on raising these little beings, and you've got so much emotional and investment in their well-being that you're just not thinking about yourself as much, and that can be a good thing. It may not be completely good, because like there's times I think where people feel like they've had all long periods of their life where they've never taken care of themselves because they're always taking care of the kids, right? And especially if the childcare burden isn't equally shared with parents. I do see it as an effect that I think for me was like largely beneficial for me. Not something that I tried to do. It's just that for about a 20-year period, I was focused on my kids, but then also interacting with families of other kids, talking about them and so forth. You just spend a lot of time talking about others.
Well, and the show we recorded just before this one was talking about how it's important to find things in life that challenge us. I don't know any parent who would say that raising a child isn't a challenge. And you know, I don't mean that in a negative way, but it has to challenge you.
Yeah, because you have no idea what you're getting into.
Yeah, especially the first one, right?
Yeah, and the first time your first child is really sick.
Yeah.
Like, it's really frightening because you're not sure what's going on and what to do. By the time the next one comes along, they're going to get over this, and, you know, like, you're just going to have a bad night. But
yeah.
So there's a lot of unknowns that you kind of figure out along the way, but that's good for you.
Thinking about our show, our last show, that it seems like people are less likely to challenge themselves or be, you know, to choose to challenge themselves in some ways. And we didn't really mention raising children in that show, but in some ways this sort of layers on top of that, right? Is that this is like, well, it's easier not to. And that would mean I can't, like, watch the shows I want to watch and go to the places on vacation I want to go to because, like, kids are expensive and you have to be around for them. So I'll just not take that challenge.
So you end up then with a very social difference. Living in a world where you have a lot of children, you come to expect them to be around, and that becomes the norm.
Yeah.
With much fewer children, and that's like the society we live in right now, it's easier, I think, to be annoyed by them because they're like, you go to a restaurant and you're sitting next to a table and there's a couple children that are kind of loud and you're not used to it and it's not that common. and you're pretty annoyed by it because it wasn't what you were expecting. But if you're living it like 100 years ago and you're going out to eat somewhere and there's children everywhere, that's what you expect. That's just the way it is. And so you go into life with a different set of expectations. And I think we become a little more open-minded when there's more children around. And children are wonderful at opening your eyes to perspectives on the world that you haven't noticed before or that you had at one time and then have forgotten, right? Because they're just, they see things and they make observations that we just, like, our brains don't think that way anymore once we get into our later years.
Well, and you mentioned like restaurants, and I still remember well a number of years ago going to like a pretty nice restaurant and sitting down, and like 5 minutes after we sit down, a table of like eight shows up, and I don't remember all the details, but like I think half of them were kids and most were under the age of like eight. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be miserable. Well, guess what? It wasn't. Why? Because they had good parents who were keeping them in line? No. It was because each one of them had an iPad they were staring at.
Oh, no. That's
so, like, for me, I'm like, I remember, like, thinking, like, halfway through the meal, I'm like, oh, gosh, I was kind of, like, worried about that table, and I haven't, like, heard a peep out of them. And then I look over, and I'm like, well, that's why.
I met a woman last week who had told me that, because I was giving a talk about third places, social connection, and how technology has destroyed a lot of our social activity. And she said she always carries a few children's books in her purse. And when she sees a little kid on an iPhone or iPad or something like that, she'll just take one of the books out and hand it to the child and says, here, you might enjoy this. And just a non-threatening way, a gift from a stranger, and just give them a book to read. I love that. And it gives her like a way of doing something constructive, not complaining about mm-hmm. the kids,
yeah.
doing something constructive. But also, like, it's a really nice kind of way of introducing yourself. And one of the things I think our young children do not have enough of right now is intergenerational interactions, especially with strangers. And so that's good.
And it's interesting, too, kind of related to that. But I remember reading something, and this person's point was that you didn't realize it at the time, but the times when you were old enough to spend time at a friend's house, and maybe you would have dinner with them, or maybe even like do a sleepover, right? But like I can remember the first time I had dinner at. Or one of the first times I had dinner at a friend's house. And of course, my parents said it was fine. All the parents thought it was a fine thing. And then the mother of my friend says, do you like ham? And of course, yeah, I like ham. I've had ham before. And so that's what we had for dinner was ham. And she brings it out. And my sister and I used to joke that we appreciated the hot lunch at school because it was oftentimes better than our mother's cooking. My mother was not, and she would also claim not to be a great cook, but the only ham I ever knew was the brand I can think of is Dubuque, but the one that was in the can that you would mm-hmm. like open up and you would put on a plate and you would heat it up somehow.
And had that jelly stuff
exactly,
around it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was what I thought ham was. And so here I am at my friend Mark's house. And she brings this out, and I did it. I wasn't going to be rude, but I'm like, well, she said she was going to make ham. I don't know what this is, but it's not ham. And then I had it, and I'm like, oh my. And then I think I somehow discovered through the conversation that this was actually ham, a different kind of ham. And it was actually like really much better than the one I was used to. So I was reading this person's work, and he was saying that there's so much you discover when you go to other people's, like being around other adults, trusted adults, like, because you realize that there are different ways to do things.
Well, and you can kind of see where this is the way the fabric of community changes when there are a lot of children, because you mentioned you have the two families that have kids on your block.
Yeah.
But imagine that every other house on the block had kids.
Three or four kids.
They would be outside all the time. The parents, a lot of the adults would be out, but they'd also be coming over to your house. Like, you would be interacting with all of your neighbors mm-hmm. a lot more if there were more kids around, because they kind of invite that social interaction.
And even in the ham example, even though my friend Mark's mother, Sally, was a better cook than my mother, like, my mother and Sally became friends over the years, because that's just, like, what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, did you realize that your kid's going to be spending time at this person's house, and you get to know them, and they're a nice person, and that's, like, normal?
The neighborhood we live in now, we moved there 25 years ago. We had a Ryder truck, and we had some friends that helped us, like, unload everything. And
so luckily, I didn't know you back then. Yeah, I would have been busy otherwise.
So it was a lot of work, and it was a hot day in the summer. Anyway, we got up in the morning, the next morning. Our kids were still asleep upstairs. We came downstairs, and we had just gotten downstairs. I was making some coffee, and the door opens up, and this little kid, 5-year-old boy, walks into our house and says, "Hi, I'm Richard." And he walks right through our kitchen. Over the other side, we had a booth in the corner of the kitchen, sits down at the kitchen table there and starts talking. And he said, you got any cereal? So, like, we pulled out some Cheerios or something. We gave him some cereal. And he had known the people who lived there before, and he used to come over and visit them. And then he heard that we have some kids. And so he thought he'd just make himself at home. And it was a great introduction to the community. And you wouldn't want an adult to do that. You get permission to a kid to do that sort of thing. They just open doors to you. And yeah, we still know Richard and follow him. He turned out to be a great kid.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, before I even have you read this, because we do share these in advance.
Yeah.
We need to make a rule. Listeners of this show may know that I had a proclivity for asking lots of parking-related questions that were a little too frequent, and so we've limited those now once per year, and that has already happened. My parking question has been done for the year, but I shared with you earlier this week a bird-related dilemma. And what did you give me? Another bird-related dilemma.
You had a goose story last week, so I thought I would come back with a duck story.
Well, so I think this does mean, though, that we are having a moratorium on future bird-related dilemmas for the rest of this year.
Okay, well,
but nonetheless, Rick,
we'll take this one.
So, what is the bird-related question for me?
So, we're in near the end of May now. This is the time of year, in Wisconsin, anyway. It's the time of year where ducks are on their nest, and we live in a small city with where the neighborhoods are not that far from bodies of water. And so there are mallards that are nesting in our neighborhoods, and they like to nest in shrubbery around houses. Let's say you get up one morning, you're getting ready to go to work, and you see a hen mallard leading a dozen little ducklings down the street. And you figure, okay, they're headed towards the marsh, which is about, from your house, maybe 10, 11 blocks, something
quite
like that.
Yep.
Which also means that they would have to cross at least three very busy streets.
Assuming they're taking the most direct route.
If they take the direct route, they might cross more than that.
Yes, yes.
What should you do?
So, of course, on the previous show, the question I asked you was, what do you do when geese sort of overtake a park and leave goose droppings behind and make the park less habitual?
Yes, that was the famous goose poop dilemma.
Yes, the goose poop dilemma. And your response was that we've sort of manufactured parks to be for people. We no longer have a scarcity of geese. So either relocating the geese or even killing the geese is probably okay because the parks are for people. So this is different, though, in a way. I mean, they've taken up residence on my lawn, mm-hmm. which I think, I want to think that like happened one day. I kind of in the back of my mind remember seeing, it was like a one day thing. But it could happen, certainly. In your scenario, it's time to head off to the nearest body of water and you know, good luck making it. I would say that I have a responsibility if I'm out driving or even if I'm like out walking down the street and I see some of a family of ducks crossing the street, I would probably like indicate to a driver coming down like, hey, you know, you may not want to run over the family of ducks because, you know, it may not be what you want to do. So I would probably do that. But
would you get out of your car?
Would I get out of my car
if you're driving along, you see the,
no, the ducklings down the road? I would certainly go out of my way to not run the ducks over. But I don't think
how
I would.
How good of you, Scott.
I would not run them over. If I were walking or biking, I would probably, and I saw a car coming, I would probably, like, there's some ducks here, do with that information what you choose. But I don't think I would go much further than that. I don't think it's my responsibility to escort them 10 blocks to the north, to the marsh, because they've made a poor choice in nesting. So, no, I don't think I would.
Huh. I thought you might.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
What if, you know, you come down, there's a school crossing guard, and you said, can I borrow your uniform and your stop sign and just escort those ducks all the way safely to the marsh?
As we've discussed in recent shows, I think it is important in life to come up with things in life that challenge us. I'm not sure this is the challenge I'm looking for, is to escort ducks across.
But you also, you wouldn't try to herd them into a box and transport them to the marsh, something like that.
Oh, goodness. I don't even know if that's something you're supposed to. No, I would have. I instantly would think of, like, you hear stories that, like, you know, you do a certain thing, the mother, like, abandons their flock, or I don't know. I wouldn't do that. I would just feel like, you know, kind of like you do with parks, that we live, some parts of our country, certainly the small parts of our country are inhabited by people like humans. And we've sort of twisted the environment to suit our needs. There is lots of open land and water where ducks can be ducks. And these ducks maybe chose poorly for reasons that I don't understand. But I'm not going to spend lots of my time having them find their way to their proper spot. Now, the other thing I'll mention is that I honestly haven't come across this a ton, but I will be curious tonight, actually. I am, as soon as we get done recording, I have this one bike route I do numerous times during the week, especially in this time of the year. And in late May, early June, in parts of this bike route, and I've not seen it yet this year, surprisingly, I will see turtles on the street. And it is and I don't want to run over a turtle with my bike because that ends badly for both of us. I will say that there are times, in my opinion, too many times, where you'll see a turtle that has gotten run over by a car, and that's not good. But
is this an adult turtle that's going to or from a nest?
Yeah, I think
so.
Laying
eggs.
Yeah,
somewhere.
And there's even signs along a route that you may be familiar with that even says that this is a place for nesting turtles. And so I'll bike along there, and I'll avoid the turtles, but I'm like happy to see them, I guess, if they're out and about. But it is interesting where I have seen drivers, I guess, maybe come to mind, like, park their cars in like weird angles to like block traffic, or even like go over and like pick the turtle up and try to like move it from one side of the road to the other. And I've never wanted to pick up a turtle, and I've never wanted to stop traffic for, again, if I were walking past and a car was coming, I might try to like indicate that they should be careful, but I don't know. I'm probably, this all makes me sound bad, and I probably don't need to give more examples, but I would not. So I'll ask you, forgetting the turtles for a moment, but with the duck example, what would you do?
Like, I know that some people do this. They will escort the ducks down to the marsh to, like, keep their distance so they're not interfering, but then wave down, like, when they're crossing the busy streets, like, stop the cars. And people are usually pleased to stop. And oftentimes they'll have somebody that joins them and gets on the other side of the ducks.
Okay.
And, you know, and they make an occasion out of it. And so I think that's admirable. I think it's a good thing to do.
I mean, I don't think it's...
But not to interfere with them, not to try to pick them up.
Like turtles, I don't know what the rules are for turtles if you're supposed to pick them up and bring them across the road. I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know about turtles. It's probably not a bad thing. It probably doesn't interfere. They probably just keep going in a straight line.
Often they're alone, so it's not like...
And they're hard to see on the asphalt.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So cars do run over them
especially
all the time.
At night. I mean, you just have no idea. But so you're saying that you respect the people who shepherd, is that the proper verb? I don't know. These ducks across the...
Yeah.
But I still have answered the question if you would be one of those people.
Probably depends on how much of a hurry I am.
It's a leisurely, Sunday afternoon. It's a beautiful day. You have nothing going on.
To escort the ducks down there, act as a crossing guard.
And then hopefully that they make it safely. Mm-hmm. And these little ducklings grow up and become healthy, and then so you can shoot them.
Exactly.
That's just weird to me. Like, I don't have any desire to, like, you know, help them across the 10 blocks of the city, but I also have, like, no desire to shoot them.
This is something I think most people that don't hunt don't understand about hunters.
But this is what we're learning.
That hunters are generally great respecters of the wildlife. And you know, and they're the ones who invest more in habitat restoration, for example, than anybody else. But it does seem emotionally contradictory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. As a species, we're kind of naturally protective of babies.
That's true. I guess lastly, maybe related, I would like to think I have a pretty broad palate of things I'll eat, but duck is just something I've never really liked.
Man.
And you?
It is delicious.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's one of those things I think I've had like twice, and maybe it just wasn't prepared. I mean, I would be open to trying it again.
When we're done with the show,
I'll
tell you where you should go for the world's best duck.
Is it within an hour drive?
It's about an hour away.
Okay. We can tell people. Is there a reason we can't tell people on the show? Okay. Well, there's a reason. Okay. Well, I don't know what the reason is, but I'll find out, I guess, and then I will know. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and he will never, ever once reveal where you get a good duck within an hour of La Crosse, Wisconsin, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.